The limit of the conference, and I was a little worried that all of the participants would have redshifted away. Fortunately not, so I can talk a little bit about the infrared limit of inflationary space-time. So that's my official title. This is based on work that appeared last month with Martin Sloth, a couple of papers. And some more work in progress. And, well, just to tell you, this won't really be a conference summary talk, even though it's the last talk, but I will certainly touch on some of the themes in this that have come up in the conference. So first of all, motivations. Well, we've heard a couple of the motivations for thinking about loops and infrared effects, the increasing sharpness of experimental tests, and the need to make very controlled theoretical predictions. We'd like to test the truth of inflation, whether it really describes what happened. And then another thing that we might think about, which hasn't come up so much at this conference, is whether inflationary spacetimes, particularly de Sitter space, have instability. So those are some of the motivations. I also have a couple of ulterior motivations for this work. One is I thought it was about time to properly learn a little real cosmology. And the second is the connection with another very interesting problem, which is quantization not in de Sitter backgrounds, but in black hole backgrounds. And this parallel has, well, been noticed by many, but in particular pushed in some recent work. And the reason why we're interested in this problem, and here, of course, I have in mind the relationship, say, between quantization on the usual kinds of slices we talk about in de Sitter and, so to speak, nice slices in black hole space-time. The reason that's an interesting problem is because in the black hole context, quantization on those kinds of slices really enters in a central way into what has been called the information paradox. And so we would really like to properly understand the question of how to describe the quantum state on such a slice. And in fact, this leads us to a proposal for how one might avoid the paradox that these nice slice states are not well defined for very long times. For example, because they can develop large fluctuations and perturbative description of them can break down. If that indeed is the correct statement, then that eliminates, well, potentially the contradiction, but would leading to a paradox, but of course leaves us with the problem of understanding what non-perturbative mechanisms unitarize the theory and in effect, get the information back out of a black hole. Yeah.
Well, so I am not giving the talk about black holes today, but let me just say I have in mind smooth slices through the black hole geometry that avoid the singularity. And there's a more precise description of the kinds of slices we're after if we're discussing the information paradox. But let's leave it at that. A family of such smooth slices, but that don't collapse into the singularity. Okay, so this is an interesting problem. Precise treatment of it is quite hard, but de Sitter space I view as an easier warm-up problem with a number of similarities.
So I'll explore a basic related theme in this talk, which is that rapid expansion produces accumulation of long-distance fluctuations of light fields, and these can produce large infrared contributions. And the question is how those affect physical quantities. And in particular, do they lead to a breakdown of perturbative gravity? So let's first start out with the essential mechanism that we encounter. And so I'll start out with de Sitter space, familiar metric. I'll use the flat slicing for essentially all of this discussion. Let's think about a massless scalar field and just compute the coincident two-point function of the massless scalar field. and see how it evolves with time. So here I'm writing, well, I basically have the wave function squared in terms of co-moving momentum. And of course, that has the usual expected ultraviolet divergence, because one is taking a coincident limit, and we might smooth that away by averaging over Hubble volumes or some other such scheme. But what we're really interested in is the fact that this is infrared divergent. I hope that helps. Is the blue too dark? Okay. I have a lot of blue, so yeah, darker is better. I didn't realize that was. Okay. Then the audience is in the dark. You can't adjust front versus back. Ah, that's terrible. Okay, I need a lighter blue next time. Ah, perfect. Thank you. Okay, so two-point function, ultraviolet divergence, and then this first term, which is arises in inflationary spacetimes, is, of course, infrared divergent. And the basic idea for where that infrared divergence comes from is that you have fluctuations that leave the horizon and accumulate at a small wave number. They become approximately classical in the process. And this pileup leads to this divergence. And the question is how that divergence is regulated. So a couple of ways that that divergence can get cut off. The first is if you have a massive theory, let's think about a very small mass as compared to the Hubble scale. In that case, the variance saturates at long times at a quantity that goes like 1 over the mass squared. So it's finite. And that is one way of regulating the divergence. As you would expect with a massive theory, you don't have infrared divergences. Another way that this divergence can get regulated is by taking inflation to have a finite duration. And that means there's a largest wavelength, shortest wave number, which cuts off the infrared behavior and gives you something of this form, basically the log of the scale factor to the beginning of inflation. And so it's this quantity where, well, you can think of, well, Ti is the time to the beginning of inflation. Is the log of the infrared cutoff. And these two cutoffs match if you take time scales related to the mass by that formula. Okay, so that's the basic mechanism, pile up of fluctuations outside the horizon. And that is true for other light fields that you have a similar infrared divergence. For example, of course, gravity. So let's think about perturbations of the gravitational field. First of all, just about De Sitter space, and think about that problem in transverse traceless gauge for the tensor fluctuations. And likewise, there you can compute the variance of the tensor field. Let's take its double trace. And again, you get an expression that is absolutely, in fact, identical to the scalar expression except for a factor of 2. So it has the same infrared divergence. You can also verify that, for example, if you want to use the global slicing of the Sitter space. So a natural question is, if you have these infrared divergences, what are they telling you? And in particular, are they giving you real physical effects? Well, I think the answer is yes, in certain contexts. The question is what context, but certainly one place where these are giving you physical effects is that these are the driving mechanism for self-reproduction. And so borrowing one of Linde's classic pictures, this is, of course, a cartoon. It is this basic mechanism of large fluctuations driving you up the hill that leads to this very, well, fanciful but non-perturbative, or at least large, well, picture with large fluctuations. So So in this case, fluctuations in the background really do get large. And then the question is, how general is this basic phenomenon? Well, to properly study it, we need some notion of the observables, which we would use to discuss the problem. And here we encounter the problem that there are no local diffeomorphism invariant observables in gravity. And so what do we do about that? Well, there have been ideas on this with a long distinguished history, all the way back to Leibniz, maybe before, but certainly Einstein enunciated such ideas, DeWitt, and so on, that you should work relationally. You should define observables relative to certain features, say, of your state. And in fact, this is basically what modern cosmologists do. For example, if you think about defining the two-point function on the reheating surface, you're defining things relative to the time set by when the scalar field reaches reheating. So that's the essential idea. Now, for sharp statements, and ultimately for some of these broader contexts like the landscape, we would like to figure out how to implement this idea in a proper quantum mechanical framework, for example, in the wave function of the universe. That is a hard problem. We've made some suggestions in work with Meralf and Hartl about how one can recover, say, approximately local observables, or recover local observables in an approximation from what we call proto-local observables. And we've made some headway, modest headway, in describing, for example, the sitter space in this kind of picture. But of course, there are serious potential pitfalls with this whole business. You can get burned, and as we've seen, there are issues with, the measure paradoxes and quandaries, Boltzmann brains, and so on. So it's certainly very subtle business. And of course, we'd like to make sharp statements, but given all of these issues, one question is whether there is a less ambitious way to make at least some modest headway. So given the infrared issues, you might ask, for example, do they make large contributions to amplitude? For example, you might consider the possibility that they would lead to large loop corrections or corrections to other amplitudes. These ultimately should be amplitudes that are of gauge invariant objects, and the idea is ultimately they will be relational with respect to the classical background, but let's not worry about that issue and just try to look at the kinds of calculations that one actually does in describing perturbations in inflation. So focusing, for example, on loops, well, a toy model for some of the loop issues is just to think about scalars, and for example, there was a recent paper which was investigating properties of bicube theories. Rich talked about his work with Cliff and others on flight of the fourth theories. Many others have worked on that. And one of the things that you find is indeed that you get large corrections for small masses. And I'll return to making that a little bit more precise later, but Rich has already said some of this. So indeed, in toy models, we do see this kind of behavior. Of course, a more generic light field is, of course, gravity, which enters the story always. And so you might try to do the same thing in the context of thinking about loop corrections from gravitons. So in fact, let's try to describe an actual calculation. And the basic formalism one follows is, what happened? is the formalism outlined by Maldacena, or used by Maldacena. Very good. Okay. And so how do you set things up? Well, let's start just with perturbations about the sitter space where we have a single scalar field. And so that's the action. And then the procedure is to start with the ADM decomposition of the metric into spatial metric and lapse and shift. Then you need to gauge fix, so you choose a gauge appropriate for the problem, effectively, well, transverse traceless gauge, about the sitter space. And then the lapse and the shift, you integrate out or solve the constraints. And then that leaves you with an action in terms of the physical degrees of freedom, sigma and the tensor perturbations, the small variations in H. And that action looks something like this. It has a quadratic term in both tensors and scalars. Then there are interactions between them, tensor, scalar, scalar, tensor, tensor, scalar, scalar. There are also terms that are higher powers in the scalar with more derivatives and so on. Those won't be important for the infrared story. But this is the starting point, and then what you'd like to do is understand how to systematically compute correlators and their loop corrections. And so, again, one might think about corrections to the two-point function of a scalar, like the two outlined here. There are other diagrams at the same order, but these are the two that dominate the infrared behavior. So if you actually sit down and try to start calculating, you find that things can rapidly get rather complicated, complicated expressions in combinatorics, particularly if you use the closed time path formalism directly. But we discovered, or at least found some slight simplification, or I think for the longer calculations, well, potentially more than slight simplification, which is a set of simple diagrammatic rules for how to do these calculations. And actually, if I can get a little light on the board, I might just say a little bit more about how to use those rules. So basically, I looked at how these kinds of calculations were being done, and it looked complicated, but I think there's a way of simplifying, for at least some purposes, some of these perturbative calculations. And the idea is to draw a dotted line corresponding to the time at which you wish to evaluate the correlator. And roughly speaking, the region below the line you think of as one half of the closed time path, and the region above is the other half. And so, for example, with a two-point function, you're going to put your external points on that dotted line. And then if you have some vertices, they can neither be above or below the line. You look at all possible combinations, modulo reflection about the line. So, for example, you have two vertices, one above and one below, and then you connect them with, in all possible ways, with propagators. So you have that diagram. And there's also a similar diagram which you actually don't count because it's a mirror reflection. So you don't need that. In the end, you take the real part, and that adds these two together. And then another part of the rules here is that the vertices above and below the dotted line are complex conjugates of one another. If you have a vertex here that's IV, you have minus IV dagger here. And then finally, the propagators that cross or connect to the dotted line are Whiteman functions. But propagators that don't cross the dotted line, like, for example, these, are Feynman functions. And so with this simple set of rules, you can actually simplify some of these calculations that are done, and in particular, simplify the problem of computing the one-loop corrections. So that's basically what we did. And then I don't need the ward light anymore. And so here we have sort of a variant in some sense. This simplifies the whole business of, well, this simplifies the business of computing in-in correlators. This is a simple way of, you know, calculating in-in correlators. So it's, you know, in some sense within the broader Schwinger-Feldisch formalism. But for us, this seemed like the most efficient way to do it. And if you go back and look at older calculations, like of the tri-spectrum from graviton exchange, actually these rules do to simplify that modestly. I think for even higher order calculations, the simplification will be less modest. There's another question.
or did it come up kind of good?
Okay, if you have a propagator up here, say, that would be a conjugate. But these ones here all either end on the line or cross the lines of the line. Okay, so one has these different contributions, say, with the, well, I've already enumerated, for example, with two vertices here, you have both a contribution that looks like this and a contribution that looks like that. I've just drawn the scalar version of the diagrams, but you can obviously replace a line by a graviton in the loop. And then, likewise, you have a diagram that comes from the quadratic interaction with the graviton. And again, there are other diagrams, but they don't enter into the infrared story. So you can actually, with some work, do, well, compute these things. Yes, in this case. Yeah, I'm looking at the scalar two-point function. And I should say there are these three contributions. I've labeled A, B, and C, and here are the actual results for the A, B, and C, scalar propagator corrections. And just to show we've really done a calculation, there's a 101 over 90, and so on. Although the dependence on the infrared cutoff is actually quite simple. So even though the calculation is hard, there is some simple structure here in, the calculation is somewhat hard in de Sitter space, and I think it obviously is going to be significantly harder if you wanted to do a real-life calculation in slow roll. But that simplicity is some suggestion that that there may be some structure you can infer from other methods. And in particular, you might wonder whether we could figure out the dependence on the infrared cutoff in some other way. Also, I just want to mention that in this particular case of de Sitter space and the two-point function of a massless scalar, there's in fact, even more than simplicity, there's a cancellation between the infrared logs in these expressions, which comes from scaling here. But of course, other correlators and also in slow roll where you don't have strictly scale invariance, you expect to have non-zero results. But so how, is there some simpler way of extracting this basic information, the dependence on the infrared? And the essential observation is that the,
for something, but what is it that doesn't have?
The two-point function of the scalar just working about de Sitter space without slow roll or anything, no roll. The two-point function of the scalar has a cancellation in the infrared degree at one loop.
Okay. Sorry, I mean, this is a massless scalar?
Yes.
So it's divergent at zero loops. So it has an infrared divergence, so I'm not sure what you mean by the cancellation.
The propagator correction. In momentum space, it's finite. It has the 1 over k cubed behavior. And I'm looking at the one loop correction in momentum space.
Okay.
Is there any additional divergence on top of that?
Okay.
See, here, you still have the 1 over k cubed, but the question is, do you have any dependence on the infrared cutoff?
Still one question. Yeah. Does Lorentz have to agree with the old calculations of Abramo, Woodard, and
I don't think anyone has done these calculations, graviton loops, spectator scalar, scalar, yet. Until, actually, there was a paper before ours. We got different answers, but I think these answers are right.
The what I'm talking about is more than 10 years ago.
No, I don't think that, I don't know that they have actually calculated this. I don't think they have.
This is graviton loops.
Okay, so how can we extract some of this simple behavior? And actually, there is a nice way to do that. The observation that leads to this is that the long wavelength fluctuations come out of the horizon and freeze, and they behave like a classical background. And so let's, for example, think about the two-point function in such a classical background and ask ourselves how it depends on that background. So for the for the moment, we'll think of gamma as just a fixed classical background. And the way that the two-point function depends on the background is through the, of course, the dependence of k squared, the norm of the wave vector, the dependence of that on the metric. And so that dependence is here, and we can expand out in the metric perturbation and find the obvious kinds of terms. And so if we think about the actual two-point function, we can likewise expand that in terms of the metric perturbations, the tensor perturbations, and we get something that looks like this, just expanding it out naively. We have to differentiate it with respect to k squared to get the coefficients. So now we can imagine that since we have this dependence on the background, let's think about an average over fluctuations of that background. And so you get a, I hope, is that readable in the background?
No.
That's really strange. I've only had this problem one other place, and that was in Moscow.
Maybe you could change the background on your.
Or tell us what you're supposed to say.
Ah, that's terrible. Okay. So what we have here is we have the two-point function in the background. It's the two-point function about zero background, and then we expand out order by order in powers of the momentum, and then we have powers of the tensor fluctuations. And so we'll take an average over the fluctuations of the background and use the fact that we know the two-point function of the tensors, the fluctuations in the background, that's given by the same kind of formula for the variance that we had before. And so we can plug that into our result, and actually, unfortunately, I think that's clear. And we see that averaging over the tensor fluctuations of the background, we get the two-point function, which is given by, well, this term involving the variance in the tensors, and then this differential operator acting on the original two-point function of the scalar. And so we've already discussed the evolution of this variance, and in particular, its infrared dependence involves log of the infrared cutoff. And in fact, that exactly reproduces the infrared divergence that we had in the explicit expressions for the one-loop amplitude. So that's the basic method, and you can apply this method in other contexts. For example, let's just think about a toy example where you have, just a scalar field. You might consider, say, phi cube theory or phi to the fourth theory, Rich and company were talking about. The same kind of method applies. You can think of expanding the field phi in terms of a fluctuation about a background. And so you write the Lagrangian in terms of that fluctuation, and then the background has the effect of shifting the mass squared term. Yeah. Yeah.
It's like, yes. There, how should one see that this infrared divergence constant here? Does this bracket operate? Does, is it zero?
Yes, actually, in the case where this is scale invariant, 1 over k cubed, this operator kills it.
So if you have a slow roll parameter, it will no longer
work. Exactly. And we'll come back to that just in a moment. Again, sorry for the difficulty in reading. Anyway. Okay, so back to another example is in the scalar case. So you can look at the change in the, say, two-point function of the scalar fluctuation in the presence of this background that you've separated off. And the same story holds since the background shifts the mass squared term.
you get a term, say, well, quadratic order proportional to the background squared, and then second derivative of the two-point function is the fluctuation with respect to the mass squared. Then if you average over the background, you get a an expression that involves now the variance of the background fluctuations, if you wish, the long wavelength fluctuations. And you know the form of that, we've already described that earlier. And so that gives you then a formula for the dependence of the correction to the two-point function on the mass. You get a 1 over m to the 6 at small m. So it's a large correction at small m. And in fact, this correction can be checked by looking at explicit results in this recent paper of Merrill and Morrison, and it matches. So that gives you some confidence that you have a valid technique for evaluating these infrared contributions. And now we'd like to apply that to the case of slow roll. So in slow roll, we'll now take into account, of course, both the dynamical scalar fluctuations and tensor fluctuations. And the corrections to the two-point function of zeta, the scalars, now again involve, well, both the variance of the graviton, slow roll parameters here. I'm not sure how clearly those can be read, but at least I'm pointing to what they are both, in this case, yeah, ns minus 1 in the scalar case. I'll show you the tensor case in a moment. And then the variance in the curvature fluctuations, ns minus 1 squared. And so those are the form of the corrections. And likewise, you can find the corrections in the same, using the same method, to the tensor two-point function, and here you have the tensor indices, nt, and again, the variance of the of zeta and the variance of gamma. So these are the leading one-loop corrections, and these quantities, the variances, as we discussed, can get large for, well, if you have long roll, so to speak, and give large shifts to, for example, the ratio of these two quantities, non-Gaussian AD parameters, and so on, you might ask if these contributions or corrections can get large, then, well, on what time scales? And the rough time scale is, well, when does the variance get large? And that gets large on a time scale which is of order 1 over the Hubble cube time. So that's a very long time in practice for, say, our discussions of the observable universe. But if you're thinking about the wave function of the entire universe, that's another matter. Yeah, I'll come back to the small box versus the large box. I'll come back to that. Why are you objecting if I'm going to talk about it? anyway, I'll come. Observable in quotes. Actually, there is an important point here that there is observable as observable to, you know, people who actually do experiments today, and then there's observable in principle, and those are different questions. And I think the difference between those is, well, you know, yeah. In principle, observable is still interesting for various reasons. We'll come back to that. Okay, so the in a general dimension, let me just say there are similar arguments which give a time scale which I have mentioned. Independent form is the de Sitter radius times the Sitter radius. Okay, so pressing on, you might ask, for example, are they really observable and are they really big corrections? For example, can we absorb those into a shift of the background? Well, let's think about one extreme example of this whole story, which again is self-reproducing inflation. And there, it's pretty clear that if you want to compute the wave function of the universe, you've got a very hard job. It's not even clear if you can in any controlled approximation. But you do expect that you can make predictions about local observables with appropriate conditionals. You can work around a little peak here where the scalar field takes some particular value and then look at the fluctuations around that value in that small region. So this brings up an important distinction between the, so to speak, small box, our observable universe, what the real people who do hard work experiments see, and the large box, which the theorists contemplate, the total inflated volume. And so we may not care observationally about the large box, but I think we do care in making contact with the fundamental theory, for one thing, in making predictions about the entire wave function of the universe, if possible. So I think it's plausible that we can resume to eliminate the large corrections for observables in the small box. We've heard some discussion of a method of approaching that, and there's also an approach known as the delta N approach. In fact, that's been applied to some of these results in a paper that came out not long after ours. And so it looks like this works in small regions for short times. But the natural question is, can this really be done for large box observables, say for the two-point function over wavelengths, all the wavelengths relevant to large box observations? And I think that's an important open question. You might, again, try to investigate that in the delta N approach and for example, based on this recent paper, and I think it remains to be seen what will come out of that. But it's also clear that there are certain regimes, I believe, where you're not going to get away with it. And one is the self-reproducing regime. There we've heard talk of various methods to compute certain gross characteristics, for example, stochastic inflation, these kinds of pictures that Lenny was talking about. Senatore was talking about the distribution function for volumes. So you may be able to capture certain features of the self-reproducing regime, but if you really wanted to have a controlled calculation of the quantum wave function of the universe, I think at least in that context, you've lost perturbative control. And so the question is, how broad is this statement? There's also this issue that you have the large two-point function that can develop for the tensors. And so a picture of that is something like this. You, after a long time of inflation, you have the space-time foam at all different very long wavelengths. And in fact, this is very similar to what we just heard in the last talk, actually measuring that, say, after a modest amount of time of inflation. But for a very long time of inflation, the variance today. Well, do we have to leave?
We're
only
at 1:30
on the clock. Oh, no. Hey, okay.
I'm almost done.
I think that was arranged. Was that what I was supposed to quit?
I told you I was going to give you 5 minute warning.
I'm almost done. And hopefully we'll escape before there are any more technology glitches. So there's a growth in this variance, and in some sense, there are quantities here that get large, the variance of the tensor fluctuations. And a plausible story, which is under investigation, is that, well, for purposes of discussing small box observables in small regions compared to the total inflated volume, it seems at least likely that you could also do a resummation and eliminate any potentially large effects. But an important question is whether globally that is possible. And it seems to me at least plausible that you can't completely eliminate, say, in the large box, the effects of this large-scale space-time foam. In order to test that, one would like to have access to some kinds of observables by which you might, in principle, these are observables in quote, might in principle describe this. Also, another suggestion is that if, in fact, you do have such an accumulation of large-scale fluctuations, that might even represent some kind of instability of this interspace. So what kinds of observables might you consider? Well, let's compare the case of self-reproduction. There you look at a global observable, in a sense, which is the total volume, and you have a distribution for that. And that can get large, or you might have large fluctuations in it. That's something that's sensitive to the curvature fluctuations. The tensor fluctuations are volume preserving. So you might try something else. For example, you might try an integral along a curve of the length, basically. You could take a curve between co-moving point masses, or a curve of non-trivial holonomy if you want to think about the analogous story where the spatial slices are, for example, free fora. So that's one way you could start investigating the effects of these large-scale tensor fluctuations, and that's one of the things we're looking at. Also, we heard described in the last talk that there are other, perhaps more pragmatic ways of measuring these kinds of fluctuations. Okay, so just to close, such perturbative gravity calculations can fail due to development of large fluctuations on large scales at large times. And the typical time scale coming out is roughly this de Sitter radius times the de Sitter entropy, possibly times small couplings, or divided by small couplings, actually. Certainly in the case of self-reproduction, you appear to have loss of perturbative control, but an important question is to really investigate whether this is a more broad issue. More generally, to think about the question of whether there really is a controlled framework for calculating the wave function of the universe. For example, perhaps by performing some resummation to a shifted background or some other method. But I think here is where we start making contact with some of the paradoxes and issues, again, of the measure for eternal inflation and so on. And then finally, I'll just again mention one thing to think about is the comparison with the analogous statements made for nice slices in black holes. There, the one final comment is we do, in fact, need for our story the state on the full slice. So I'll stop there. And even within time, with all of the...
Steve, I might have expected that the effect of all of things could be summarized as a effective shift of operator dimensions, some sort of conformal field theory description of times.
Okay. Well, I don't know. It's a very good question. You think that the you can
well correlation functions should be restricted by conformal invariants. And what should they be restricted to? They should be restricted to some sort of correlators in a conformal field theory.
Mm-hmm.
So they should be in the case of operator dimensions, and I might have expected the effect of these things would just be to shift the operator dimensions.
Well, let's take an extreme example. Your picture of horrendously terrible things on
the computer. No, I'm not thinking about eternal. I was thinking about imagining a stable de Sitter space.
That's a good question. For purposes of describing, say, local quantities, the two-point function in some small region, that seems to me it could well be part of the story.
What do you mean by small region?
A region that, there is actually a measure which involves this this scale, R times S, which is the time scale, and it corresponds to, another way of saying it is inflating for the time comparable, a number of equal things that is the entropy, the de Sitter entropy. So the question is for more global quantities, whether indeed you have such a simple description in terms of, say, a shifted background or shifted dimensions, and for that, I don't know. It's an important question to investigate.
The conformal field theory picture is a global picture.
Yes, the proposed conformal field theory picture is supposed to be global.
And in low orders, correlation functions are power laws.
Okay.
If the symmetry persists, mm-hmm. What else can happen except the power laws get shifted?
Well, yeah, I I think it's an important question to try to understand that properly.
Any other important question?
Have you got any two-loop calculation?
No, but our rules will make those simple. I don't know that we're going to do that.
So, sometimes we would have, in fact, have done a two-loop calculation. Then they claim that they get a sort of back reacting
everything. I think it's a different calculation. We could try to figure out exactly what they did.
Their claim is that they get the sort of back reaction which eats up if you raise the cosmological constant.
Yeah.
So, do you have any comment with respect to what you said?
That's probably related
to what Constantine does.
Yeah, that's not something I have checked carefully and gone through. I feel that is a surprising result that the instability of the zero space is such that it destroys the cosmological constant. I think many people are surprised by that statement. We'll see when all the dust settles. It seems to me that this development of these large-scale fluctuations could, in a sense, be more modest, let's call it instability, and then you've got to figure out exactly what you mean by instability. So when you have this imprint, it appears of large fluctuations at large scales, which can be also large. So,
when you study the higher order corrections, are you extrapolating to plus infinity and working out what this means on the future space-like infinity for this?
You can follow things to this time scale where the one-loop correction is of order of the tree level, so to speak, and then at that point, I don't think you really should be extrapolating beyond there unless you perform summary summation such that you restore a controlled perturbative approximation, and that's part of the problem.
Okay. So that's what you're trying to find is some...
Well, see how far you can jump, right, for example, and retain perturbative control.
But for the system, you don't have any correction. It's just for the snorrel inflation that you have a correction.
For the particular correlators I was talking about, it's true the correction cancels. And that actually may be related to running state models.
All right, there's no other questions. There's two items of business, but before we get to those, we should thank. Do you have something you want to say?
Since I'm the last speaker, I thought I would issue a thank you to the organizers. But maybe you were going to do that.
That was one of the items of business, yeah. But
let me just say, on behalf of all of the participants, including those who have gone past the horizon, not everyone, thanks, a big thanks to the organizers for a very stimulating and enjoyable conference.
So I'm applauding them because I'm